rereading the first exercise book in which Harry had written about the time before he was sent to Lavenham. As she turned each page and was made aware once again what he had been willing to put himself through in order to release her from any obligation she might feel she owed him, Emma resolved that if she ever found the idiotic man again, she wouldn't let him out of her sight. With Mr. Ginsburg's blessing, Emma became involved with every aspect of publishing the revised edition of The Diary of a Convict, or the first edition, as she always referred to it. She attended editorial meetings, discussed the cover lettering with the head of the art department, chose the photograph that would go on the back cover, wrote the blurb about Harry for the inside flap, and even addressed a sales conference. 6 weeks later, boxes of books were transported from the printer by rail, truck, and plane to depositories all across America. On publication day, Emma was standing on the pavement outside Doubleday's, waiting for the doors of the bookstore to open. She was able to report to Great Aunt Phyllis and Cousin Alistair that evening that the book had been running out of the shop. Confirmation of this came in the form of the New York Times bestseller list the following Sunday, when the revised edition of The Diary of a Convict appeared in the top 10 after only a week's sales. Journalists and magazine editors from all over the country were desperate to interview Harry Clifton and Max Lloyd. But Harry couldn't be found in any penal establishment in America, while Lloyd, to quote the Times, was unavailable for comment. The New York News was less prosaic when it ran the headline, "Lloyd on the Lam." On the day of publication, Sefton Jelks's office issued a formal statement making it clear that the company no longer represented Max Lloyd. Although The Diary of a Convict hit the number one spot on the New York Times bestseller list for the next 5 weeks, Ginsburg kept to his agreement with Jelks and did not publish any extracts from the earlier notebook. However, Jelks did sign a contract giving Viking the exclusive right to publish all of F. Scott Fitzgerald's works for the next 50 years. Jelks considered that he'd honoured his side of the bargain and that, given time, the press would become bored with the story and move on. And he might have been right if Time magazine hadn't run a full-page interview with the recently retired Detective Carl Kalowski of the New York Police Department.
"And I can tell you," Kalowski was quoted as saying, "that so far they've only published the boring bits. Just wait until you read what happened to Harry Clifton before he arrived at Lavenham."
The story hit the wires around 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and Mr. Ginsburg had received over 100 calls by the time he walked into his office the following morning. Jelks read the article in Time as he was driven to Wall Street. When he stepped out of the lift on the 22nd floor, he found three of his partners waiting outside his office. Chapter 39.
"Which do you want first?" asked Phyllis, holding up two letters. "The good news or the bad news?"
"The good news," said Emma without hesitation as she buttered another piece of toast. Phyllis placed one letter back on the table, adjusted her pince-nez, and began to read the other.
"Dear Mrs. Stewart, I've just finished reading The Diary of a Convict by Harry Clifton. There was an excellent review of the book in the Washington Post today, which towards the end posed a question about what happened to Mr. Clifton after he left Lavenham Correctional Facility 7 months ago, having completed only a third of his sentence. For reasons of national security, which I am sure you will appreciate, I am unable to go into any great detail in this letter. If Miss Barrington, who I understand is staying with you, would like any further information concerning Lieutenant Clifton, she is welcome to contact this office, and I will be happy to make an appointment to see her. As it does not breach the Official Secrets Act, may I add how much I enjoyed Lieutenant Clifton's diary. If the rumours in today's New York Post are to be believed, I can't wait to find out what happened to him before he was shipped off to Lavenham. Yours sincerely, John Cleverdon, Colonel.
Great Aunt Phyllis looked across to see Emma bouncing up and down like a bobby soxer at a Sinatra concert. Parker poured Mrs. Stewart a second cup of coffee, as if nothing unusual was taking place a few feet behind him. Emma suddenly stood still. "So what's the bad news?" she asked, sitting back down at the table. Phyllis picked up the other letter.
"This one is from Rupert Harvey," she declared. "A second cousin once removed."
Emma stifled a laugh. Phyllis observed her critically over her pince-nez.
"Don't mock, child," she said. "Being a member of a large clan can have its advantages, as you're about to discover."
She turned her attention back to the letter.
"Dear Cousin Phyllis, how nice to hear from you after all this time. It was kind of you to draw my attention to the Diary of a Convict by Harry Clifton, which I thoroughly enjoyed. What a formidable young lady Cousin Emma must be."
Phyllis looked up. "Twice removed in your case," she said, before returning to the letter.
"I'd be delighted to assist Emma in her current dilemma. To that end, the embassy has an aircraft that will be flying to London next Thursday, and the ambassador has agreed that Miss Barrington can join him and his staff on the flight. If Emma would be kind enough to drop by my office on Thursday morning, I will make sure that all the necessary paperwork is completed. Do remind her to bring her passport with her. Yours affectionately, Rupert. P.S. Is Cousin Emma half as beautiful as Mr. Clifton suggests in his book?" Phyllis folded the letter and placed it back in the envelope. "So what's the bad news?" demanded Emma.
Phyllis bowed her head, as she did not approve of displays of emotion, and said quietly,
"You have no idea, child, how much I shall miss you. You are the daughter I never had."
"I signed the contract this morning," said Ginsburg, raising his glass.
"Congratulations," said Alistair, as everyone else around the dinner table raised their glasses.
"Do you forgive me," said Phyllis, "if I appear to be the only one among us who doesn't fully understand? If you signed a contract that prevents your company from publishing Harry Clifton's earlier work, what exactly are we celebrating?"
"The fact that I put $100,000 of Sefton Jelks's money into my company's bank account this morning," Ginsburg replied.
"And I," said Emma, "have received a check for $20,000 from the same source. Lloyd's original advance for Harry's book."
"And don't forget the check for $10,000 you failed to pick up for Mrs. Clifton, which I retrieved," said Ginsburg.
"Frankly, we've all done very well out of it, and now the contract has been signed, there will be even more to come for the next 50 years.
"Possibly," said Phyllis, taking the high ground. "But I'm more than a little irked that you've allowed Jelks to get away with murder."
"I think you'll find he's still on death row, Mrs. Stewart," said Ginsburg, "though I accept we've granted him a 3-month stay of execution."
"I'm even more confused," said Phyllis.
"Then allow me to explain," said Ginsburg. "You see, the contract I signed this morning wasn't with Jelks, but with Pocketbooks, a company who have bought the rights to publish all Harry's diaries in softback."
"And what, may I ask, is a softback?" said Phyllis.
"Mamma," said Alistair, "softbacks have been around for years now."
"So have $10,000 bills, but I've never seen one."
"Your mother makes a fair point," said Ginsburg. "In fact, it could explain why Jelks was taken in.
Because Mrs. Stewart represents an entire generation who will never come to terms with books being published in softback and would only ever consider reading a hardback. What made you realize that Jelks was not fully acquainted with the concept of a softback? Asked Phyllis.
F. Scott Fitzgerald was the clincher, said Alistair.
I do wish you wouldn't use slang at the dinner table, said Phyllis. It was Alistair who advised us, said Emma, that if Jelks was willing to hold a meeting in his office without his legal assistant present, it must mean he hadn't alerted his partners to the fact there was a missing notebook, and that if it were published, it would be even more damning to the firm's reputation than the diary of a convict. Then why didn't Alistair attend the meeting, said Phyllis, and make a record of everything Jelks said? After all, that man is one of the slipperiest lawyers in New York.
Which is precisely why I didn't attend the meeting, Mother. We didn't want anything on the record, and I was convinced that Jelks would be arrogant enough to think that all he was up against was a slip of a girl from England and a publisher he was sure he could bribe, which meant we had him by the short and curlies.
Alistair!
However, Alistair continued, now in full flow, it was just after Emma had stormed out of the meeting that Mr. Ginsburg displayed a moment of true genius.
Emma looked puzzled.
He told Jelks, I look forward to seeing you again once the contract has been drawn up.
And that's exactly what Jelks did, said Ginsburg. Because once I'd gone over his contract, I realized it was modeled on one that had originally been drawn up for F. Scott Fitzgerald, a man who was only ever published in hardback. There was nothing in that contract to suggest that we couldn't publish in softback. So the subcontract I signed this morning will allow Pocketbooks to publish Harry's earlier diary without breaking my agreement with Jelks.
Ginsburg allowed Parker to refill his glass with champagne.
How much did you make? Demanded Emma.
There are times, young lady, when you push your luck.
How much did you make? Asked Phyllis.
$200,000, admitted Ginsburg.
You'll need every penny of it, said Phyllis, because once that book goes on sale, you and Alistair will be spending the next couple of years in court defending yourself against half a dozen libel writs.
I don't think so, said Alistair, after Parker had poured him a brandy. In fact, I'd be willing to bet that $10,000 bill you've never seen, Mama, that Sefton Jelks is now spending his last 3 months as the senior partner of Jelks, Myers and Abernathy.
What makes you so sure of yourself?
I have a feeling Jelks didn't tell his partners about the first notebook, so when Pocketbooks publish the earlier diary, he will be left with no choice but to hand in his resignation.
And if he doesn't?
Then they'll throw him out, said Alistair. A firm which is that ruthless with its clients won't suddenly become humane with its partners. And don't forget, there's always someone else who wants to be senior partner. So, I'm bound to admit, Emma, you're far more interesting than Amalgamated Wire versus New York Electric, said the others in unison as they raised their glasses to Emma.
And should you ever change your mind about staying in New York, young lady, said Ginsburg, there'll always be a job for you at Viking.
Thank you, Mr. Ginsburg, said Emma. But the only reason I came to America was to find Harry, and now I discover that he's in Europe while I'm stranded in New York. So once I've had my meeting with Colonel Cleverdon, I'll be flying home to be with our son.
Harry Clifton's a damn lucky man to have you in his corner, said Alistair wistfully.
If you ever meet either of them, Alistair, you'll realize that I'm the lucky one.
Chapter 40 Emma
woke early the following morning and chatted happily to Phyllis over breakfast about how much she was looking forward to being reunited with Sebastian and her family. Phyllis nodded, but said very little. Parker collected Emma's bags from her room, took them down in the lift, and left them in the hall. She'd acquired another two since arriving in New York. Does anyone ever go home with less than they started out with? She wondered.
I'll not come downstairs, said Phyllis, after several attempts to say goodbye. I'll only make a fool of myself. It's better that you simply remember an old battle axe who didn't like to be disturbed during her bridge parties. When you visit us next time, my dear, bring Harry and Sebastian with you. I want to meet the man who captured your heart.
A taxi blasted its horn in the street below.
Time to go, said Phyllis. Go quickly.
Emma gave her one last hug, and then she didn't look back. When she stepped out of the lift, Parker was standing by the front door waiting for her, the bags already stowed away in the boot of the taxi. The moment he saw her, he walked out onto the pavement and opened the back door of the cab.
Goodbye, Parker, said Emma, and thank you for everything.
My pleasure, ma'am, he replied.
Just as she was about to step into the taxi, he added,
If it's not inappropriate, ma'am, I wondered if I might be allowed to make an observation.
Emma stepped back, trying to mask her surprise.
Of course, please do.
I so enjoyed Mr. Clifton's diary, he said, that I hope it will not be too long before you return to New York, accompanied by your husband.
It wasn't long before the train was speeding through the countryside, and New York was no more, as they headed towards the capital. Emma found she couldn't read or sleep for more than a few minutes at a time. Great-Aunt Phyllis, Mr. Ginsburg, Cousin Alistair, Mr. Jelks, Detective Kalowski, and Parker all made their exits and entrances. She thought about what needed to be done once she arrived in Washington. First, she had to go to the British Embassy and sign some form so she could join the ambassador on his flight to London, as arranged by Rupert Harvey, a second cousin twice removed.
"Don't mock, child,"
she could hear her great-aunt remonstrating. And then she fell asleep. Harry entered her dreams, this time in uniform, smiling, laughing. And then she woke with a jolt, quite expecting him to be in the carriage with her. When the train pulled into Union Station 5 hours later, Emma had trouble lugging her suitcases onto the platform until a porter, an ex-serviceman with one arm, came to her rescue. He found a taxi for her, thanked her for the tip, and gave her a salute with the wrong arm. Someone else whose destiny had been decided by a war he didn't declare.
The British Embassy,
Emma said as she climbed into the cab. She was dropped on Massachusetts Avenue, outside a pair of ornate iron gates displaying the Royal Standard. Two young soldiers ran across to help Emma with her bags.
Who are you visiting, ma'am?
An English accent, an American word.
Mr. Rupert Harvey, she said.
Commander Harvey, certainly,
said the corporal, who picked up her bags and guided Emma to an office at the rear of the building. Emma entered a large room in which the staff, most dressed in uniform, scurried about in every direction. No one walked. A figure appeared out of the melee and greeted her with a huge smile.
I'm Rupert Harvey, he said. Sorry about the organised chaos, but it's always like this when the ambassador is returning to England. It's even worse this time because we've had a visiting cabinet minister with us for the past week. All your paperwork has been prepared, he added, returning to his desk. I just need to see your passport.
Once he'd flicked through the pages, he asked her to sign here, here, and here.
A bus will be leaving from the front of the embassy for the airport at 6 this evening. Please make sure you're on time, as everyone's expected to be on board the plane before the ambassador arrives.
I'll be on time, said Emma. Would it be possible to leave my bags here while I go sightseeing?
That won't be a problem, said Rupert. I'll have someone put them on the bus for you.
Thank you, said Emma.
She was about to leave when he added,
By the way, I love the book. And just to warn you, the minister is hoping to have a private word with you when we're on the plane. I think he was a publisher before he went into politics.
What's his name? Emma asked.
Harold Macmillan.
Emma recalled some of Mr. Ginsburg's sage advice.
Everyone is going to want this book, he told her. There isn't a publisher who won't open their doors for you, so don't be easily flattered. Try and see Billy Collins and Alan Lane of Penguin.
He'd made no mention of a Harold Macmillan.
Then I'll see you on the bus around 6, said her second cousin twice removed, before he disappeared back into the melee.
Emma left the embassy, walked out onto Massachusetts Avenue, and checked her watch. Just over 2 hours to spare before her appointment with Colonel Cleverdon. She hailed a cab.
Where to, miss?
I want to see everything the city has to offer, she said.
How long have you got? A couple of years?
No, Emma replied. A couple of hours. So let's get moving.
The taxi sped away from the curb. First stop, the White House, 15 minutes. Onto the Capitol, 20 minutes. Circling the Washington, Jefferson, and Lincoln memorials, 25 minutes. Dashing into the National Gallery, another 25 minutes. Ending up at the Smithsonian. But there was only 30 minutes left until her appointment, so she didn't make it past the first floor. When she jumped back into the cab, the driver asked,
Where to now, miss?
Emma checked the address on Colonel Cleverdon's letter. 3022 Adam Street, she replied, and I'm cutting it fine. When the cab drew up outside a large white marble building that occupied the entire block, Emma handed the cabbie her last $5 note. She would have to walk back to the embassy after her meeting. Worth every cent, she told him. He touched the rim of his cap.
I thought it was only us Americans who did that sort of thing, he said with a grin.
Emma walked up the steps past two guards who stared right through her and on into the building. She noticed that almost everyone was dressed in different shades of khaki, although few of them wore battle ribbons. A young woman behind the reception desk directed her to room 9197. Emma joined a mass of khaki uniforms as they headed towards the lifts, and when she stepped out on the 9th floor, she found Colonel Cleverdon's secretary waiting to greet her.
I'm afraid the colonel has got caught up in a meeting, but he should be with you in a few minutes, she said as they walked along the corridor.
Emma was shown into the colonel's office. Once she had sat down, she stared at a thick file on the center of the desk. As with the letter on Maisie's mantelpiece and the notebooks on Jelks's desk, she wondered how long she would have to wait before its contents were revealed. The answer was 20 minutes. When the door eventually swung open, a tall, athletic man, around the same age as her father, burst into the room, a cigar bobbing up and down in his mouth.
So sorry to have kept you, he said, shaking hands, but there just aren't enough hours in the day.
He sat down behind his desk and smiled at her.
John Cleverdon, and I would have recognized you anywhere.
Emma looked surprised, until he explained,
You're exactly as Harry described you in his book. Would you like coffee?
No, thank you, said Emma, trying not to sound impatient as she glanced at the file on the colonel's desk.
I don't even have to open this, he said, tapping the file. I wrote most of it myself, so I can tell you everything Harry's been up to since he left Lavenham. And now, thanks to his diaries, we all know he should never have been there in the first place. I can't wait to read the next installment and find out what happened to him before he was sent to Lavenham.
And I can't wait to find out what happened to him after he left Lavenham, Emma said, hoping she didn't sound impatient.
Then let's get on with it, said the colonel. Harry volunteered to join a special services unit, which I have the privilege of commanding, in exchange for his prison sentence being commuted. Having begun his life in the United States Army as a GI, he was recently commissioned in the field and is currently serving as a lieutenant. He's been behind enemy lines now for several months,
he continued.
He's been working with resistance groups in occupied countries and helping to prepare for our eventual landing in Europe.
Emma didn't like the sound of that. What does behind enemy lines actually mean?
I can't tell you exactly, because it's not always easy to track him down when he's on a mission. He often cuts off communication with the outside world for days on end. But what I can tell you is that he and his driver, Corporal Pat Quinn, another Lavenham graduate, have turned out to be two of the most effective operatives to come out of my group. They're like two schoolboys who've been given a giant chemistry set and told they can go and experiment on the enemy's communications network.
They spend most of their time blowing up bridges, dismantling railway lines, and bringing down electricity pylons. Harry's specialty is disrupting German troop movements, and on one or two occasions the Krauts have nearly caught up with him. But so far, he's managed to stay a step ahead of them. In fact, he's proved such a thorn in their flesh that they've put a price on his head, which seems to go up every month. 30,000 francs when I last checked.
The colonel noticed that Emma's face had gone as white as a sheet.
I'm so sorry, he said. I didn't mean to alarm you, but I sometimes forget, when I'm sitting behind a desk, just how much danger my boys face every day.
When will Harry be released? Asked Emma quietly.
I'm afraid he's expected to serve out his sentence, said the colonel.
But now that you know he's innocent, can't you at least send him back to England?
I don't think that would make a great deal of difference, Miss Barrington, because if I know Harry, the moment he set foot in his homeland, he'd only swap one uniform for another.
Not if I have anything to do with it, the colonel smiled.
I'll see what I can do to help,
he promised as he rose from behind his desk. He opened the door and saluted her.
Have a safe journey back to England, Miss Barrington. I hope it won't be long before the two of you end up in the same place at the same time.
Harry Clifton, 1945. Chapter 41. I'll report back, sir, as soon as I've located them, said Harry, before putting the field phone down.
Located who?
Asked Quinn. Kirtle's army. Colonel Benson seems to think they could be in the valley on the other side of that ridge, he said, pointing to the top of the hill.
There's only one way we're going to find out, said Quinn,
shifting the jeep noisily into first gear. Take it easy, Harry told him. If the Hun are there, we don't need to alert them. Quinn remained in first as they crept slowly up the hill. That's far enough, said Harry, when they were less than 50 yards from the brow of the hill. Quinn put the handbrake on and turned the ignition off, and they jumped out and ran on up the incline. When they were only a few yards from the top, they fell flat on their stomachs. Then, like two crabs scurrying back into the sea, they crawled until they stopped just below the crest. Harry peeped over the top and caught his breath. He didn't need a pair of binoculars to see what they were up against. Field Marshal Kirtle's legendary 19th Armoured Corps was clearly preparing for battle in the valley below. Tanks were lined up as far as the eye could see, and the support troops would have filled a football stadium. Harry estimated that the 2nd Division of the Texas Rangers would be outnumbered by at least 3-1.
If we get the hell out of here, whispered Quinn, we might just have enough time to prevent Custer's second-to-last stand.
Not so fast, said Harry. We might be able to turn this to our advantage.
Don't you think we've used up enough of our 9 lives during the past year?
I've counted 8 so far, said Harry, so I think we can risk just one more.
He began to crawl back down the hill before Quinn could offer an opinion.
Have you got a handkerchief?
Harry asked as Quinn climbed behind the wheel.
Yes, sir,
he said, taking one out of his pocket and passing it to Harry, who tied it to the jeep's radio mast.
You're not going to...
Surrender? Yes, it's our one chance, said Harry. So drive slowly to the top of the ridge, Corporal, and then on down into the valley. Harry only ever called Pat Corporal when he didn't want to prolong the discussion.
Into the Valley of Death, suggested Quinn.
Not a fair comparison, said Harry. There were 600 in the Light Brigade, and we are but 2, so I see myself more like Horatius than Lord Cardigan.
I see myself more like a sitting duck.
That's because you're Irish, said Harry, as they crested the ridge and began the slow journey down the other side. Don't exceed the speed limit, he said, trying to make light of it. He was expecting a hail of bullets to greet their impudent intrusion, but clearly curiosity got the better of the Germans. Whatever you do, Pat, Harry said firmly, don't open your mouth. And try to look as if this has all been planned in advance. If Quinn had an opinion, he didn't express it, which was most unlike him. The corporal drove at a steady pace and didn't touch the brake until they reached the front line of tanks. Kirtle's men stared at the occupants of the jeep in disbelief. But no one moved until a major pushed his way through the ranks and headed straight for them. Harry leapt out of the jeep, stood to attention and saluted, hoping his German would be up to it.
What in God's name do you imagine you're doing? Asked the major.
Harry thought that was the gist of it. He maintained a calm exterior.
I have a message for Field Marshal Kirtle from General Eisenhower, Supreme Commander of the Allied Forces in Europe.
Harry knew that when the major heard the name Eisenhower, he couldn't risk not taking it to a higher level. Without another word, the major climbed into the back of the jeep, tapped Quinn on the shoulder with his baton, and pointed in the direction of a large, well-camouflaged tent that stood to one side of the assembled troops. When they reached the tent, the major leapt out.
Wait here,
he ordered, before going inside. Quinn and Harry sat there, surrounded by thousands of wary eyes.
If looks could kill, whispered Quinn.
Harry ignored him. It was several minutes before the major returned.
What's it going to be, sir?
Mumbled Quinn.
The firing squad? Or will he ask you to join him for a glass of schnapps?
The Field Marshal has agreed to see you, said the major,
not attempting to hide his surprise.
Thank you, sir,
Harry said as he got out of the jeep and followed him into the tent. Field Marshal Kirtle rose from behind a long table that was covered in a map that Harry recognized immediately, but this one had models of tanks and soldiers all heading in his direction. He was surrounded by a dozen field officers, none below the rank of colonel. Harry stood rigidly to attention and saluted.
Name and rank?
The field marshal asked after he had returned Harry's salute.
Clifton, sir. Lieutenant Clifton. I am General Eisenhower's ADC.
Harry spotted a Bible on a small folding table by the field marshal's bed. A German flag covered the canvas of one side of the tent. Something was missing.
And why would General Eisenhower send his ADC to see me?
Harry observed the man carefully before answering his question. Unlike Goebbels or Goering's, Kirtle's battle-worn face confirmed that he had seen frontline action many times. The only medal he wore was an Iron Cross with oak leaf cluster, which Harry knew he'd won as a lieutenant at the Battle of the Marne in 1918. General Eisenhower wishes you to know that on the far side of Clemenceau, he has three full battalions of 30,000 men, along with 22,000 tanks. On his right flank is the 2nd Division of the Texas Rangers. In the center, the 3rd Battalion of the Green Jackets, and on their left flank, a battalion of the Australian Light Infantry. The Field Marshal would have made an excellent poker player because he gave nothing away. He would have known that the numbers were accurate, assuming those three regiments were actually in place.
Then it should prove a most interesting battle, Lieutenant. But if your purpose was to alarm me, you have failed.
That is no part of my brief, sir, Harry said, glancing down at the map. Because I suspect I haven't told you anything you didn't already know, including the fact that the Allies have recently taken control of the airfield at Wilhelmsburg. A fact that was confirmed by a small American flag pinned on the airport on the map. What you may not know, sir, is that lined up on the runway is a squadron of Lancaster bombers, awaiting an order from General Eisenhower to destroy your tanks, while his battalions advance in battle formation. What Harry knew was that the only planes at the airfield were a couple of reconnaissance aircraft, stranded because they'd run out of fuel.
Get to the point, Lieutenant, said Kirtle. Why did General Eisenhower send you to see me?
I will try to recall the General's exact words, sir. Harry attempted to sound as if he were reciting a message. There can be no doubt that this dreadful war is fast drawing to a close, and only a deluded man with a limited experience of warfare could still believe victory is possible. The allusion to Hitler did not go unnoticed by the officers who surrounded their field marshal. That was when Harry realized what was missing. There was no Nazi flag or picture of the Führer in the field marshal's tent. "General Eisenhower holds you and the 19th Corps in the highest regard," Harry continued. "He has no doubt that your men would lay down their lives for you, whatever the odds. But in the name of God," he asks, "for what purpose? This engagement will end with your troops being decimated, while we will undoubtedly lose vast numbers of men. Everyone knows that the end of the war can only be a matter of weeks away. So what can be gained by such unnecessary carnage?" "General Eisenhower read your book, The Professional Soldier, when he was at West Point, sir. And one sentence in particular has remained indelibly fixed in his memory throughout his military career." Harry had read Kirtle's memoirs a fortnight before, when he realized they might be up against him. So he was able to recite the sentence almost word for word. "Sending young men to an unnecessary death is not an act of leadership, but of vainglory and unworthy of a professional soldier." "That, sir, is something you share with General Eisenhower. And to that end, he guarantees that if you lay down your arms, your men will be treated with the utmost dignity and respect, as set out in the Third Geneva Convention." Harry expected the field marshal's response to be, "Good try, young man, but you can tell whoever it is commanding your puny brigade on the other side of that hill that I am about to wipe them off the face of the earth." But what Kirtle actually said was, "I will discuss the general's proposal with my officers. Perhaps you will be kind enough to wait outside." "Of course, sir." Harry saluted, left the tent, and returned to the jeep. Quinn didn't speak when he climbed back into the front seat and sat beside him. It was clear that Kirtle's officers were not of one opinion, as raised voices could be heard from inside the tent. Harry could imagine the words honour, common sense, duty, realism, humiliation, and sacrifice being bandied about. But the two he feared most were, "He's bluffing." It was almost an hour before the major summoned Harry back into the tent. Kirtle was standing apart from his most trusted advisers, a world-weary look on his face. He had made his decision, and even if some of his officers didn't agree with it, once he had given the order, they would never question him. He didn't need to tell Harry what that decision was. "Do I have your permission, sir, to contact General Eisenhower and inform him of your decision?" The field marshal gave a curt nod, and his officers quickly left the tent to see that his orders were carried out. Harry returned to his jeep, accompanied by the major, and watched 23,000 men lay down their arms, climb out of their tanks, and line up in columns of three as they prepared to surrender. His only fear was that, having bluffed the field marshal, he wouldn't be able to pull off the same trick with his area commander. He picked up his field phone and only had to wait a few moments before Colonel Benson came on the line. Harry hoped the major hadn't noticed the bead of sweat that was trickling down his nose. "Have you discovered how many of them were up against Clifton?" were the colonel's first words. "Could you put me through to General Eisenhower, Colonel? This is Lieutenant Clifton, his ADC. "Have you gone out of your mind, Clifton?" "Yes, I will hold on, sir, while you go and look for him." His heart couldn't have beaten faster if he'd just run 100 yards, and he began to wonder how long it would be before the colonel worked out what he was up to. He nodded at the major, but the major didn't respond. Was he standing there hoping to find a chink in his armour? As he waited, Harry watched thousands of fighting men, some perplexed, while others looked relieved, joining the ranks of those who had already abandoned their tanks and laid down their arms.
"It's General Eisenhower here."
"Is that you, Clifton?"
said Colonel Benson when he came back on the line.
"Yes, sir, I'm with Field Marshal Kirtle, and he has accepted your proposal that the 19th Corps lay down their arms and surrender under the terms of the Geneva Convention, in order to avoid, if I remember your words correctly, sir, unnecessary carnage."
If you bring forward one of our 5 battalions, they should be able to carry out the operation in an orderly fashion. I anticipate coming over Clemenceau Ridge, accompanied by the 19th Corps. He looked at his watch. At approximately 1700 hours.
We'll be waiting for you, Lieutenant.
Thank you, sir. 50 minutes later, Harry crossed the Clemenceau Ridge for the second time that day, the German battalion following him as if he were the Pied Piper, over the hill and into the arms of the Texas Rangers, as the 700 men and 214 tanks surrounded the 19th Corps. Colonel realized he had been duped by an Englishman and an Irishman, whose only weapons were a jeep and a handkerchief. The field marshal pulled a pistol from inside his tunic, and Harry thought for a moment that he was going to shoot him. Colonel stood to attention, saluted, placed the pistol to his temple, and pulled the trigger. Harry felt no pleasure in his death. Once the Germans had been rounded up, Colonel Benson invited Harry to lead the 19th Unarmored Corps in triumph to the compound. As they drove at the head of the column, even Pat Quinn had a smile on his face. They must have been about a mile away when the jeep passed over a German landmine. Harry heard a loud explosion and remembered Pat's prophetic words.
"Don't you think we've used up enough of our 9 lives during the past year?"
As the jeep cartwheeled into the air before bursting into flames. And then, nothing. Chapter 42. Do you know when you're dead? Does it happen in an instant and then suddenly you're no longer there? All Harry could be sure of was the images that appeared before him were like actors in a Shakespearean play, each making their exits and entrances. But he couldn't be sure if it was a comedy, a tragedy, or a history. The central character never changed and was played by a woman who gave a remarkable performance, while others seemed to flit on and off the stage at her bidding. And then his eyes opened and Emma was standing by his side. When Harry smiled, her whole face lit up. She bent down and kissed him gently on the lips.
"Welcome home," she said.
That was the moment when he realized not only how much he loved her, but also that now nothing would ever keep them apart. He took her gently by the hand.
"You're going to have to help me," he began. "Where am I? And how long have I been here?" "Bristol General, and just over a month. It was touch and go for a while, but I wasn't going to lose you a second time."
Harry gripped her hand firmly and smiled. He felt exhausted and drifted back into a deep sleep. When he woke again, it was dark, and he sensed that he was alone. He tried to imagine what might have happened to all those characters during the past 5 years, because, as in Twelfth Night, they must have believed he'd died at sea. Had his mother read the letter he wrote to her? Had Giles used his colour blindness as an excuse not to be called up? Had Hugo returned to Bristol once he was convinced Harry was no longer a threat? Were Sir Walter Barrington and Lord Harvey still alive? And one other thought kept returning again and again. Was Emma waiting for the right moment to tell him there was someone else in her life? Suddenly, the door to his room was thrown open, and a little boy came running in, shouting, "Daddy, Daddy, Daddy!" before leaping onto his bed and throwing his arms around him. Emma appeared moments later and watched as the 2 men in her life met for the first time. Harry was reminded of the photograph of himself as a boy that his mother kept on the mantelpiece in Stillhouse Lane. He didn't have to be told that this was his child, and he felt a thrill he couldn't have begun to imagine before. He studied the boy more closely as he leapt up and down on the bed, his fair hair, blue eyes, and square jaw just like Harry's father.
"Oh my God,"
said Harry, and fell into a deep sleep. When he woke again, Emma was sitting on the bed beside him. He smiled and took her hand.
"Now I've met my son. Any other surprises?"
he asked. Emma hesitated before adding with a sheepish grin,
"I'm not sure where to start."
"At the beginning, possibly," said Harry, "like any good story.
Just remember that the last time I saw you was on our wedding day."
Emma began with her trip to Scotland and the birth of their son, Sebastian. She just pressed the doorbell of Kristin's apartment in Manhattan when Harry fell asleep. When he woke again, she was still with him. Harry liked the sound of Great-Aunt Phyllis and her cousin, Alistair, and although he could only just remember Detective Kalowski, he would never forget Sefton Jelks. When Emma came to the end of her story, she was on a plane crossing the Atlantic back to England, sitting next to Mr. Harold Macmillan. Emma presented Harry with a copy of The Diary of a Convict. All Harry said was,
"I must try and find out what happened to Pat Quinn."
Emma found it difficult to find the right words.
"Was he killed by the landmine?"
Harry asked quietly. Emma bowed her head. Harry didn't speak again that night. Each day produced new surprises because, inevitably, everyone's life had moved on in the 5 years since Harry had seen them. When his mother came to visit him the following day, she was on her own. He was so proud to learn that she was excelling at reading and writing and was deputy manager of the hotel, but was saddened when she admitted she had never opened the letter delivered by Dr. Wallace before it disappeared.
"I thought it was from a Tom Bradshaw," she explained.
Harry changed the subject.
"I see you're wearing an engagement ring as well as a wedding ring."
His mother blushed.
"Yes, I wanted to see you on my own before you met your stepfather."
"My stepfather?" said Harry.
"Anyone I know?" "Oh, yes," she said,
and would have told him who she'd married if he hadn't fallen asleep. The next time Harry woke, it was the middle of the night. He switched on the bedside light and began to read The Diary of a Convict. He smiled several times before he reached the last page. Nothing Emma told him about Max Lloyd came as a surprise, especially after Sefton Jelks had made a reappearance. However, he was surprised when Emma told him that the book had been an instant bestseller and that the follow-up was doing even better.
"The follow-up?"
inquired Harry.
"The first diary you wrote about what happened to you before you were sent to Lavenham has just been published in England. It's racing up the charts here, as it did in America. That reminds me, Mr. Ginsberg keeps asking when he can expect your first novel, the one you hinted at in The Diary of a Convict." "I've got enough ideas for half a dozen," Harry said. "Then why don't you get started?"
asked Emma. When Harry woke that afternoon, his mother and Mr. Holcomb were standing by his side, holding hands as if they were on their second date. He had never seen his mother looking so happy.
"You can't be my stepfather," Harry protested as the two shook hands.
"I most certainly am," said Mr. Holcomb. "Truth is, I should have asked your mother to be my wife 20 years ago, but I simply didn't think I was good enough for her."
"And you're still not good enough, sir," said Harry with a grin. "But then neither of us ever will be."
"Truth be known, I married your mother for her money."
"What money?" said Harry.
"The $10,000 Mr. Jelks sent, which made it possible for us to buy a cottage in the country."
"For which we will be eternally grateful," chipped in Maisie.
"Don't thank me," said Harry. "Thank Emma."
If Harry was taken by surprise when he discovered that his mother had married Mr. Holcomb, it was nothing compared to the shock when Giles walked into the room, dressed in the uniform of a lieutenant in the Wessex Regiment. If that wasn't enough, his chest was covered in combat medals, including the Military Cross. But when Harry asked how he'd won it, Giles changed the subject.
"I'm planning to stand for Parliament at the next election," he announced.
"To which seat have you granted this honour?"
asked Harry.
"Bristol Docklands," Giles replied.
"But that's a safe Labour seat, and I intend to be the Labour candidate."
Harry made no attempt to hide his surprise.
"What caused this St. Paul-like conversion?"
he asked.
"A corporal I serve with on the front line, called Bates."
"Not Terry Bates," said Harry.
"Yes. Did you know him?"
"Sure did. The brightest kid in my class at Merriwood Elementary. And the best sportsman. He left school at 12 to work in his father's business, Bates and Son, butchers."
That's why I'm standing as a Labour candidate, said Giles. Terry had just as much right to be at Oxford as you or me. The following day, Emma and Sebastian returned, armed with pens, pencils, pads, and an India rubber. She told Harry the time had come for him to stop thinking and start writing. During the long hours when he couldn't sleep or was simply alone, Harry's thoughts turned to the novel he had intended to write if he hadn't escaped from Lavenham. He began to make outline notes of the characters that must turn the page. His detective would have to be a one-off, an original, who he hoped would become part of his readers' everyday lives, like Poirot, Holmes, or Maigret. He finally settled on the name William Warwick. The Honourable William would be the second son of the Earl of Warwick, and have turned down the opportunity to go to Oxford, much to his father's disgust, because he wanted to join the police force. His character would be loosely based on his friend, Giles. After 3 years on the beat, walking the streets of Bristol, Bill, as he was known to his colleagues, would become a detective constable and be assigned to Chief Inspector Blakemore, the man who'd intervened when Harry's Uncle Stan had been arrested and wrongly charged with stealing money from Hugo Barrington's safe. Lady Warwick, Bill's mother, would be modelled on Elizabeth Barrington. Bill would have a girlfriend called Emma, and his grandfathers, Lord Harvey and Sir Walter Barrington, would make the occasional entrance on the page, but only to offer sage advice. Every night, Harry would read over the pages he'd written that day, and every morning his waste paper basket needed emptying. Harry always looked forward to Sebastian's visit. His young son was so full of energy, so inquisitive and so good-looking, just like his mother, as everyone teased him. Sebastian often asked questions no one else would have dared to. What's it like being in prison? How many Germans did you kill? Why aren't you and Mama married? Harry sidestepped most of them, but he knew Sebastian was far too bright not to work out what his father was up to, and feared it wouldn't be long before the boy trapped him. Whenever Harry was alone, he continued to work on the outline plot for his novel. He'd read over 100 detective novels while he was working as deputy librarian at Lavenham, and he felt that some of the characters he'd come across in prison and in the army could provide material for a dozen novels. Max Lloyd, Sefton Jelks, Warden Swanson, Officer Hessler, Colonel Cleverdon, Captain Havens, Tom Bradshaw, and Pat Quinn. Especially Pat Quinn. During the next few weeks, Harry became lost in his own world. But he had to admit that the way some of his visitors had spent the last 5 years had also turned out to be stranger than fiction. When Emma's sister Grace paid him a visit, Harry didn't comment on the fact that she looked so much older than when he'd last seen her, but then she'd only been a schoolgirl at the time. Now Grace was in her final year at Cambridge and about to sit her exams. She told him with pride that for a couple of years she'd worked on a farm, not going back up to Cambridge until she was convinced the war was won. It was with sadness that Harry learnt from Lady Barrington that her husband, Sir Walter, had passed away, a man Harry had admired second only to old Jack. His uncle Stan never visited him. As the days went by, Harry thought about raising the subject of Emma's father, but he sensed that even the mention of his name was off limits. And then one evening, after Harry's doctor had told him that it wouldn't be too long before they released him, Emma lay down next to him on the bed and told him that her father was dead. When she came to the end of her story, Harry said, "You've never been good at dissembling, my darling. So perhaps the time has come to tell me why the whole family is so on edge." Chapter 43. Harry woke the next morning to find his mother, along with the whole Barrington family, seated around his bed. The only absentees were Sebastian and his uncle Stan, neither of whom, it was felt, would have made a serious contribution. "The doctor has said you can go home," said Emma. "Great news," said Harry. "But where's home? If it means going back to Stillhouse Lane and living with Uncle Stan, I'd prefer to stay in hospital. Even go back to prison." No one laughed. "I'm now living at Barrington Hall," said Giles. "So why don't you move in with me? Heaven knows there are enough rooms." "Including a library," said Emma.
so you'll have no excuse not to continue working on your novel.
And you can come and visit Emma and Sebastian whenever you want to, added Elizabeth Barrington. Harry didn't respond for some time. You're all being very kind, he eventually managed, and please don't think I'm not grateful. But I can't believe it needed the whole family to decide where I'm going to live.
There's another reason we wanted to talk to you, said Lord Harvey. And the family have asked me to speak on their behalf.
Harry sat bolt upright and gave Emma's grandfather his full attention.
A serious issue has arisen concerning the future of the Barrington estate, began Lord Harvey. The terms of Joshua Barrington's will have turned out to be a legal nightmare, rivaled only by Jarndyce and Jarndyce, and could end up being just as financially crippling.
But I have no interest in either the title or the estate, said Harry. My only desire is to prove that Hugo Barrington was not my father, so I can marry Emma.
Amen to that, said Lord Harvey. However, complications have arisen that I must acquaint you with.
Please do, sir, because I can't see that there's any problem.
I'll try to explain. Following Hugo's untimely death, I advised Lady Barrington that as she had recently suffered two onerous demands for death duties, and remembering that I am over 70, it might be wise for our two companies, Barrington's and Harvey's, to join forces. This, you understand, was at a time when we still believed you were dead. Therefore, it seemed that any dispute over who would inherit the title and the estate had, however unhappily, been resolved, making it possible for Giles to take his place as head of the family.
And he still can, as far as I'm concerned, said Harry.
The problem is that other interested parties have become involved, and the implications now go far beyond the people in this room. When Hugo was killed, I took over as chairman of the newly merged company and asked Bill Lockwood to return as managing director. Without blowing my own trumpet, Barrington Harvey has paid its shareholders a handsome dividend for the past 2 years, despite Herr Hitler. Once we realized you were still alive, we took legal advice from Sir Danvers Barker, K.C., to be sure that we were not in breach of the terms of Joshua Barrington's will.
If only I'd opened that letter, said Maisie, almost to herself.
Sir Danvers assured us, continued Lord Harvey, that as long as you renounce any claim to the title or the estate, we could continue trading as we had for the previous 2 years. And indeed he drew up a document to that effect.
If someone hands me a pen, said Harry, I'll happily sign it.
I wish it were that easy, said Lord Harvey. And it might have been if the Daily Express hadn't picked up the story.
I'm afraid I'm to blame for that, Emma interrupted, because following the success of your book on both sides of the Atlantic, the press have become obsessed with finding out who will inherit the Barrington title. Will it be Sir Harry or Sir Giles?
There's a cartoon in the News Chronicle this morning, said Giles, of the two of us on horseback, jousting, with Emma sitting in the stands, offering you her handkerchief, while the men in the crowd boo and the women cheer.
What are they alluding to? Asked Harry.
The nation is divided right down the middle, said Lord Harvey. The men only seem interested in who'll end up with the title and the estate, while the women all want to see Emma walking up the aisle a second time. In fact, between you, you're keeping Cary Grant and Ingrid Bergman off the front pages.
But once I've signed the document renouncing any claim to the title or the estate, surely the public will lose interest and turn their attention to something else.
This might well have been the case had the Garter King of Arms not become involved.
And who's he? Asked Harry.
The king's representative when it comes to deciding who is next in line for any title. 99 times out of 100, he simply sends letters patent to the next of kin. On the rare occasions when there's a disagreement between two parties, he recommends that the matter be settled by a judge in chambers.
Don't tell me it's come to that, said Harry.
I'm afraid it has. Lord Justice Shawcross ruled in favour of Giles's claim, but only on the condition that once you were fully fit, you signed a disclaimer, waiving your rights to the title and the estate, while allowing the succession to progress from father to son.
Well, I am fully fit now, so let's make an appointment to see the judge and get this settled once and for all.
I'd like nothing more, said Lord Harvey, but I'm afraid the decision has been taken out of his hands.
By who this time? Asked Harry.
A Labour peer called Lord Preston, said Giles. He picked up the story in the press and tabled a written question to the Home Secretary, asking him to make a ruling on which one of us was entitled to inherit the baronetcy. He then held a press conference at which he claimed that I had no right to succeed to the title, because the real candidate was lying unconscious in a Bristol hospital, unable to put his case. Why would a Labour peer give a damn if it was me or Giles who inherited the title?
When the press asked him the same question, said Lord Harvey, he told them if Giles inherited the title, it would be a claim.